This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Crimes and Consequences. Hope you had a great week. I have an awesome story to tell you today, Tanya. Super excited to tell you and our listeners. It's one of my favorite true crime stories, and I'm not sure why. Just really good.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it.
With that being said, do we have any business?
No.
Well, let's start.
Let's do it.
Normally, 21-year-old Stacy Scott wouldn't willingly allow a man to blindfold her while she was standing in an unfamiliar garage at an unfamiliar home. But she trusted William Cody Neal. He goes by Cody. And when he told her to remove her glasses so he could tie a bath towel around her eyes, she did. Against her better judgment, she went as far as letting Cody apply duct tape over her mouth.
Duct tape?
Let me explain. In the month that she'd known Cody, he'd always been fun. He was a very playful guy. He never gave any clues to the depths of his depravity, which Stacy would momentarily learn all about. She wasn't the first victim to fall for his bullshit charm. And later that night, Stacy would discover that she wouldn't be his last either. Cody had been dating Stacy's roommate. Her name was Beth. She was 35. She was a little bit older than Stacy. Stacy and Beth worked together. Cody had been dating Beth exclusively for maybe about a month, but casually for a few months. He was always over the top with everything he did. He took both women on shopping sprees. He'd pick them up in limos. And Beth and Stacy's lives had been filled with excitement, extravagance, and spontaneity since Cody entered the picture. The two roommates met him one night in late 1997. So this is 6 months earlier than when she decided to allow him to blindfold and duct tape her. Stacy and Beth, along with some coworkers, had decided to catch a drink after work. They went to this local dive bar in Denver called Shipwrecks. Now, Beth being 35, she was closer in age to Cody. He was 42. And Cody was a regular at Shipwrecks. His larger-than-life cowboy persona was always on full display for everyone, anywhere he went. Most of the time, he could be found wearing a black cowboy hat, a black shirt, tight blue jeans, boots, and a black full-length duster coat to top it off. It was a stroke to his ego when people would call him Wild Bill Cody, a nickname he was very proud of. After the first encounter, Beth and Stacy began hanging out with him more often at Shipwrecks. They started going there, and he would be there, and they would have drinks and sit at the table. And then they started hanging out with him at other places, different restaurants and bars. He always paid for all the rounds whenever they went out, explaining that money was one thing he had plenty of. According to Cody, he had a lavish mansion in Las Vegas and another one in Denver that he used as his main home. He even brought with him a 3-ring binder that contained multiple photos of his mansions that he would show to anybody that doubted him.
Okay, that's a little weird.
He's proud of it.
I guess.
He told tales of his days as a bounty hunter and hinted that he worked as a hitman for the mob, whom he referred to as the family. And that's how he got all his money. In the spring of 1998, to celebrate Stacy's upcoming birthday, Cody invited her and Beth to this very swank restaurant in Denver to have some drinks. At the restaurant, he introduced them to a woman he said was a friend of his named Angie Fite. Now, Stacy had the sense that there was something going on between Cody and Angie, that they were more than just friends. But Beth didn't agree, and probably because she had started to develop a crush on Cody. A few days later, when it was Stacy's actual birthday, she was laying down in her bed when she heard Beth come into the apartment with Cody. Beth tapped on Stacy's door and told her that Cody had a birthday present that he wanted to give to Stacy. And this just gives you an idea of how Cody was. He walked in and he started tossing $100 bills all over her bed. And as great as that might sound, it made her uncomfortable because she didn't really know him all that well, and that was a pretty generous present. As the months passed, Cody and Beth's relationship started becoming more exclusive, as I told you, or so Beth thought. However, it wasn't really exclusive on Cody's part. Around mid-June, and this is only a few weeks before Stacy allows herself to be blindfolded, Cody confided to Stacy that he had a big surprise for Beth. Now, Beth was divorced with kids, and she didn't have a lot of money, so he told Stacy he wanted to help her out. He was going to get her a home and a car, but insisted that Stacy keep it a secret from her roommate. He also had another surprise for Stacy. Besides being a bounty hunter and a former hitman, Cody said he owned a large mortgage company in Las Vegas, and he offered Stacy a job working for him. Now, Stacy wasn't stupid. She wondered why he would want her to work for him because she had absolutely no experience in the mortgage industry at all. But what he described was a job opportunity that one only gets once in a lifetime. The pay was more money than she'd ever dreamed of making. And she would travel between Las Vegas and Denver, which at 21 she thought would be kind of fun. But before she could start working for him, there was one thing she had to do. She had to meet with his two lawyers in Vegas to sign a contract. Cody told her that he would arrange for the two of them to fly down together and stay the night right after the 4th of July holiday. Stacy was a bit uncomfortable with the idea of spending the night out of town with her roommate's boyfriend. But Beth assured her it'd be fine. Cody was harmless. If she only knew that two other women thought the same thing and now lay dead in pieces.
Uh-oh.
In the early evening of July 5th, Cody pulled up to Stacy and Beth's apartment in his white Toyota truck to pick Stacy up and take her to the airport. Stacy dressed in a business attire. She was wearing a peach blouse and navy dress pants to serve as a reminder that this trip was strictly business. Cody looked at his watch. They had plenty of time before the flight, so he suggested they go catch a drink at a place called Fugly's.
Fugly's.
I love that. Fugly's. During their conversation there, Cody told Stacy that Beth's big surprise that he had spoken of previously, the house and the car, they were going to be ready in a few days. But unfortunately, Cody would be out of town. So he was going to need Stacy to act as a sort of surrogate for him, to take his place and present the big surprise. Of course, Stacy agreed. After leaving Fugly's, they started driving to the airport, and Cody suggested that they make a real quick stop to the house that he purchased for Beth, since it was on the way. He told Stacy, maybe we could do a little dress rehearsal of sorts to make sure you know exactly how I want the surprise to go down. Cody pulled into the driveway of this two-story townhouse on West Chenango Drive. It's in a rural community called Lakeview. And Lakeview is just northwest of Denver. He used the automatic garage door opener to open the garage, and he pulled inside, and he quickly shut the door behind him. After they got out of the vehicle, Cody told Stacy that he wanted Beth to be blindfolded and asked Stacy to remove her glasses so he could blindfold her, since she was now playing the role of Beth.
This is creepy.
Then he ripped a piece of duct tape off a roll and he gently put it over her mouth. And now you know why Stacy is blindfolded with duct tape on her mouth. He led her into the home. His beloved cat tried to escape from the door, so Cody picked her up and he let Stacy pet her. This was just another way to disarm Stacy so her guard would be lowered. Then he guided Stacy down a short hallway into the living room. Because of the blindfold, Stacy couldn't see the horror that painted the walls and the floors of the room. She most likely wouldn't have been able to without the blindfold anyway, because every single window in the townhouse and every door that had a window was covered with brown butcher paper.
That's weird.
When Stacy looked down from her blindfold, she could see just a little bit of the floor, and she could tell that the floors were bare, which is plywood. There was no carpeting. She figured that Cody maybe hadn't finished remodeling the place for Beth yet. After walking a short distance into the living room, Cody told Stacy to sit down. When she went to sit, she noticed the seat was very low to the ground. And after sitting on it, she realized it wasn't a chair. It was a mattress. That's when Stacy knew something was very wrong. She is now blindfolded, duct taped, and sitting on a mattress in the middle of a living room in a house she's never been in. But it gets worse. At each corner of the mattress were four very large eye bolts that Cody had screwed into the floor.
Oh, man.
Each eye bolt had nylon rope tied through it. He ordered Stacy to lie down on the mattress, spread eagle, and he tied each of her limbs to the eye bolts. When she started to cry, Cody told her to shut up, saying, quote, "You haven't seen me cold and mean, and you don't want to," end quote. The fun and entertaining man she had known was gone. He was replaced by something much more sinister. He started unbuttoning her peach blouse with one hand while pressing a cold steel blade against her neck. He used the knife to cut her bra, her navy slacks, and her underwear off her. Then he pulled up a white patio chair next to her, and he asked her a very horrifying question. He asked her if she'd ever seen a human skull in real life.
Oh, geez. This is fucked up.
Stacy could hear the sound of shuffling around the room, and then Cody crouched down beside the mattress. He removed the towel tied around her head, and he showed her an ice cream bar wrapper he was holding in his hands. He opened up the wadded paper and he pulled out a bloody skull that had long blonde hair attached to it. He put it on top of Stacy's bare belly and left it there for a few minutes, relishing in her utter revulsion.
What?
What the fuck is that?
What? Okay, it's a skull with hair?
Yeah.
Like the real hair or is it a wig?
No, it's real hair. It's a chunk of a skull.
Oh.
It's a few inches. And I'll talk about it in a little bit.
My God.
I can't believe the son of a bitch left it there. Satisfied by her terror, he grabbed the skull and he tossed it across the room where it landed on a large object that was wrapped inside black garbage bags. Now, this is the first time Stacy can actually see. So she scanned her surroundings. She realizes she's laying on this mattress in the living room, in this townhouse, and she could tell it was in the midst of being remodeled, but never got finished. Like someone started the project and didn't finish it. The living room and dining room area, it was one large open space, and almost every inch was covered with dirty dishes and rotting food. And there was this awful stench in the townhouse.
Oh no, it's never good.
Next to the mattress was a small table, and it had an ashtray overflowing with cigarettes, which served as a centerpiece, because Cody was a chain smoker. As I mentioned earlier, every window had brown butcher paper tape covering it, as if it had been prepped for painting. There was a fireplace on one side of the living room with a second large bundle laying next to it, covered in a blanket. With a touch of arrogance, Cody strolled over to one of the lumps on the floor. He reached under the blanket and pulled up a woman's leg, still clad with a sock and shoe, as if he was showing off a prize.
Oh my God.
Of course, Stacy reacted in horror, and he just dropped the leg to the floor. Cody walked over to the mattress, and as he did, he kicked the second bundle that lay wrapped in garbage bags. If Stacy thought things couldn't get any worse for her, she was wrong.
Oh no.
Cody announced to her that he was leaving to go get a friend, and he would be right back. He warned her do not try to escape or cause any problems because he had friends upstairs who wouldn't hesitate to rape and kill her. Once again, Cody covered her mouth with duct tape. For Stacy's entertainment, he turned on the TV to a country music video station.
Oh, nice. How pleasant of him.
He threw a blanket over her entire body, so she was completely covered, and he left in his truck. After about two commercial breaks, Stacy heard the rumbling of the garage door opening. The door that led from the garage to the house then opened, and she could hear Cody talking to someone. 28-year-old Angela Fite met Cody in the beginning of 1998. She had just left her husband, Mike, with whom they shared two small children. And she is the one I told you met with Stacy and Beth and Cody for dinner once. She worked as a waitress at Fugly's, and she also was a dental assistant, but she was struggling to make ends meet. Cody became her knight in shining armor. He would shower both her and her children with affection and lavish gifts. He would pay her babysitter $100 to watch her kids, and sometimes he even babysat her kids, and they were like 2 and 4. He offered to pay for her lawyer fees during the divorce and told her one day he might even get her a house near her mom's home. Because after all, money was no object for Cody. Cody confided to Angie that he was a former hitman for the mob, and he still had connections with him, which is where his money came from. Angie had no idea that Cody was dating Beth at the same time as her. As the months went by, cracks began surfacing in their relationship. Cody wouldn't let Angie know where he lived for her own safety.
Uh-huh.
Bunch of bullshit. And Angie was expressing her doubts in some of Cody's wild tales. She also began talking to her estranged husband about the possibility of reconciliation. Angie was almost ready to give up on her relationship with Cody, but all of that changed on July 4th. Cody called Angie and told her he had a big surprise for her.
Oh, I bet.
He had purchased a townhouse just down the street from her mother's and asked her if she would like to see it. Angie couldn't believe what she was hearing. And Cody was a very good manipulator. He described the townhouse to her in detail. He told her it was fully furnished and remodeled, minus some carpeting. But he told her it's a secret and not to tell anybody about the house until it was time for her to move in. Of course, Angie told her sister, which got to. I mean, right. I'm buying your house. I'm going to say, listen, Tanya, don't tell anybody.
It's just between you and me.
Cody arranged to meet Angie at Fiddlesticks, a bar, at 8 p.m. the next day, July 5th. Angie arrived early and waited for Cody, ordering a drink for herself. Cody showed up in his Toyota truck, and he followed Angie back to her apartment to drop off her car. Now, in retrospect, Angie probably should have wondered why he didn't just pick her up at her place. Regardless, Just as Cody promised, he drove Angie past her mother's house and he slowed the truck down, pulling into the garage of the West Chenango townhouse. Angie truly believed that her biggest dream of being a homeowner was coming true. After stepping out of the truck, Cody insisted on blindfolding Angie.
Oh, Lord.
To enhance the surprise. He guided her through the first floor into the living room, and he sat her down on a dining room chair that he had placed in the middle of the living room. Somehow, he convinced her to let him bind her wrists to the armrests with duct tape. She also allowed him to tape her ankles.
What?
To the leg of the chairs.
Girl.
He's very convincing. As he's rolling out the duct tape, he made small talk with Angie. He asked her how her day was going so far. When he was done taping her, he asked her to try to get up to see if she was secured. And she managed to get the duct tape off. So he had her sit back down.
Let me do it tighter now.
And that's what he did.
Oh my God.
That's exactly.
This is messed up.
What he did. Once she was tightly bound to the chair, he slowly removed the blindfold that had covered her eyes. And with a sense of accomplishment in his voice, he said to Angie, quote, "Welcome to my mortuary."
Oh. Oh my God.
It took Angie a second to adjust to the lighting, but when she did, she was stunned by the horror before her. On the floor in front of her was a mattress with four large eye bolts at each corner, screwed into the bare floor, and she could see nylon rope trailing from the eye bolts, leading to some object under a blanket on the mattress. To the right was something against the wall, wrapped like a mummy in garbage bags. It had ropes tied around it.
Oh my God.
And a few feet further was a similar shape covered by a blanket. And Angie knew. There were dead bodies. Cody walked over to the mattress. He reached his hand under the blanket and started groping Stacy until she flinched. Then, like a magician revealing his secrets, he pulled the blanket off, revealing Stacy's bound and naked body to Angie.
Ta-da!
That's basically right? How it was.
Oh my God, this is terrifying.
The two women recognized each other from having that dinner. And in a voice overcome with terror, Angie said to Stacy, quote, "I'm sorry, but we're not going to get out of here alive, are we?" End quote. Cody ignored the exchange and sat down on a plastic patio chair that was beside the mattress. He lit a cigarette. He liked marble reds. And because of his smoking, just so you know, he had a chronic cough. He reached down and he peeled the duct tape from Stacy's mouth and offered her a hit of a cigarette.
How kind.
She said, why not? She accepted.
I'm going to die anyway.
Right?
Might as well.
Then he walked over to Angie and he let her take a puff. He asked Angie if she thought she could smoke her own cigarette without using hands because she's duct taped to a chair. And she said she thought she could. So he lit one and he put it in her mouth. Then he made a joke to the women about having to feed his cat or give his cat a treat from the kitchen. So he went into the kitchen. A few moments later, Cody resurfaced into the living room in a sort of stealth-like manner. And he stood behind Angie in full sight of Stacy. He was carrying a 7.5-pound splitting maul that he had purchased days earlier at the Builder's Square. For those who don't know what a splitting maul is, such as myself.
And me.
It's a tool and it's the size of a baseball bat. And at the end is a blade. And one side of it is an axe and the other side is a sledgehammer.
Oh my God.
This is 7.5 pounds. So think of it as a half axe, half sledgehammer tool.
Okay.
The splitting maul that Cody was holding was covered with dried blood, brain matter, and hair.
Oh, Jesus.
Cody lifted it up and he swung it back down as hard as he could into the center of Angie's head.
Oh my God.
Right in front of Stacy.
Yeah.
That cigarette she'd been smoking popped out of her mouth and fell to the floor. Her body instantly slumped towards the side, but the duct tape kept her remaining upright. as Cody struck again and again and again and again and yet again. Angie's head just turned to mush. Angie was hit with the axon of the maul 6 times. When he was satisfied with his destruction, Cody put the axe down. He picked up Angie's lit cigarette from the floor and sat down on the patio chair next to the mattress to finish smoking it.
This dude's a psycho.
Isn't that crazy? As he's sitting next to Stacy, the sound of Angie's blood pouring, not dripping, but pouring out of her head became too much for him. He got up and he placed a blanket under her head, commenting as he did it to Stacy, quote, "You see how calm and smooth I am? I bet you didn't know that was coming."
End quote. Yeah, no shit, dude. None of us did.
Right?
Angie, Stacy. Oh my God.
When he finished Angie's cigarette, he took off his cowboy boots, his tight blue jeans, and his underwear. It was Stacy's turn to suffer. He untied one of Stacy's hands and he made her stroke his penis until he got an erection. At some point during all this, he brought out a small caliber handgun and he untied Stacy's other hand and ankles. He walked over to where Angie's massacred body was and stood by the chair right next to it. At gunpoint, he ordered Stacy to kneel down on the floor next to Angie's body and perform oral sex on him. He placed the barrel of the gun to her temple and asked her if she wanted to die. She was less than 12 inches from Angie.
Oh my God, this is sick.
He then ordered her back to the mattress and made her get on her hands and knees so he could rape her. When he was done, he retied one of Stacy's wrists to the eye bolt, leaving the other one free. And he tied her legs together and then tied them to an eye bolt with a nylon cord. He sat next to her on the patio chair and he started watching a movie. After a few minutes, Cody broke the awkward silence and asked Stacy if she knew what show he was watching. It was called Portrait of a Serial Killer, which is a drama about Henry Lee Lucas and Otis O'Toole. He started mumbling something about Angie having to die because she couldn't be trusted. And Stacy kind of just went along with it, hoping to gain his favor. She's like, yeah, Angie had to go.
Yeah, you couldn't trust her. What? Oh my God.
Cold and humiliated in her nakedness, Stacy asked Cody for a blanket. And he gave her one and covered her up in it. Stacy was beyond terrified that at any moment, Cody might sneak up on her and strike her with a maul. So she asked Cody to come lay next to her. And then she asked him to hold one of her hands. And he did. That's pretty much how they laid for the rest of the night. The next morning, Cody allowed Stacy to use the bathroom and get dressed. The bathroom was a little bit odd. It was basically empty. There was no toothbrushes, no toothpaste, no razors, no toiletries, only just one bottle of shampoo in the shower. After Stacy got dressed, Cody tucked the handgun into his waistband and ordered her into the Toyota truck that was parked in the garage. Stacy noticed he had a 12-gauge shotgun behind the seat, which wasn't there before. Cody took Stacy to the apartment she shared with Beth and had her bring in the suitcases that she had packed for their Vegas trip. He allowed Stacy to take a shower. And while she was showering, he went around and he took all the phones he could find in the apartment, mostly cordless phones. He was scheming up a grand finale, and he needed to make sure that his victims couldn't call for help. Later, Cody drove Stacy to a place called the Bonfire Lounge, and he ordered a beer for her and a Bacardi and Coke for himself.
Oh my God. What?
What? I'd need a shot of vodka. Then he asked the waitress, a woman he knew named Maggie, for a burger and fries for him and some nachos for Stacy, because I'm sure Stacy's just super hungry.
Yeah, she really wants those nachos.
After finishing their lunch, the two went to a store so Cody could get some Tums because he had some indigestion probably from the Bacardi and rum and burger and fries. Disgusting. bastard. He also purchased some NyQuil because of this chronic cough. He took Stacy to the mall, to a Radio Shack, where he purchased a tape recorder. He was going to need that for later in the evening. After Radio Shack, Cody drove them to a local video store, and he rented a movie called Jekyll.
Why isn't she making a scene in any of these places?
Pretty sure there's a little PTSD going on there, Tanya.
I'm sure she is, but...
I'm just saying.
I mean, he took her to like 10 places.
And I bet insane. In the back of her mind, she's sure he's got a splitting mole in his back pocket and is going to hit her in the head. I mean, she is all shades messed up. Finally, when he's done with all of his errands, the two go back to Stacy's apartment and they wait for Beth to come home from work. Beth was greeted at the door by Cody. He was affectionate and playful towards her, as if nothing was wrong.
Hi, honey.
Poor Stacy, you know she's rocking in the corner.
Oh my God.
Somehow Stacy, in the midst of all her trauma, managed to fake being okay and not raise Beth's suspicions. Together, the three sat in the living room and watched Jekyll. Now, earlier, Cody had made a promise to Stacy. He told her after the movie was finished, he would confess everything he did to Beth. And true to his word, when the movie ended, Cody asked Beth and Stacy to join him at the dining room table. He began explaining the past few days to Beth in graphic detail. Beth screamed, and Cody busted out a gun, pointing it to her head. She calmed down, and he got out a tape recorder. He pressed the record button, and he spent the next 2 hours describing the murders of multiple amazing women who had fallen for the charm of Wild Bill Cody. But before I tell you everything he did, I'm going to take a quick break. Before I go into Cody's confession, I want to give you just a brief background on his history. In Cody's own words, he was raised in an all-American family. His father was a chief warrant officer in the Air Force, and his mother was a homemaker who devoted her life to her children. His father adored his mother and basically did anything she wanted for her. Everybody that ever met Cody's mom loved her. Cody was a happy child, filled with joy and light inside him. That's how he described himself. But he said at the age of 13, he willingly had sex with a married woman who was older than him, and he knew it was wrong, and it made him feel dirty, and that's when the light went out. In turn, he molested a younger girl, but he didn't get caught for the crime. Not long after that, he killed a cat with a fork in front of his older brother, Phil.
What?
Yeah, I mean, that's a sign there's something not right. According to Cody, he was molested at around the age of 15 by a church elder, but he never told anybody about it, so this is self-reporting. When he was 17, he joined the Army, and he claims he was raped by an Army sergeant. Cody spent his adulthood basically manipulating and conning women. He abused all of his wives, and he had four of them.
Oh my God.
He was a lover.
Four wives?
He was a lover. He's a romancer. Cody's fourth wife, her name was Jennifer. She was a 19-year-old stripper when she met and married him. She didn't want to be a stripper. She needed to make some money to earn a living, so I'm not judging her. She really desperately just wanted a family and a family life. And Cody promised her the world. But instead, he gave her pure hell. She described how on one occasion, while she and Cody were at a hotel supposed to be having a romantic evening together, unbeknownst to her, it was a swingers hotel.
Oh, Lord.
He convinced her to let him blindfold her and tie her to the bed. While they were having sex, Cody got up briefly and he opened the curtains. Then they continued to have sex. Jennifer heard what sounded like a hotel room door opening, and Cody paused for a minute and got up, and then the sex started again, only it wasn't Cody. He had allowed a man into the room who thought he was participating in consensual sex. As soon as he found out he wasn't, he got up off Jennifer.
Because she was blindfolded?
Because she was blindfolded.
What a sick bastard.
And opening the curtains was a sign.
That was the signal, it's okay to come in. Wow.
What had once been romance with lovemaking, because that's how Cody starts out with all of his relationships, ended up turning into sex on demand. When Cody would say, are you ready for this? Potty for daddy. That meant he was horny and she needed to put out.
What?
Potty for daddy.
That's fucking weird.
During their 2 years marriage, Jennifer got pregnant and gave birth to Cody's daughter. He had no interest in this child and shortly thereafter left Jennifer. However, he would come back to her and she would take him back and they'd go on and off. The final straw for Jennifer occurred when she went out to dinner with a girlfriend and Cody agreed to watch their daughter, who was about 11 months old. When Jennifer got back, Cody told her that he'd given their daughter a bath, fed her, and put her to bed. And this little girl always loved her tub time. The next day, when Jennifer went to give her a bath, the baby freaked out. Aww. And she continued to hysterically cry during tub times. So Jennifer was convinced that Cody did something to that little girl, and she left him. Cody used his charm and his charisma to manipulate every woman he ever dated or married. For decades, he siphoned their bank accounts dry. He embezzled from employers, and he lived the life of a typical con artist. He'd gotten away with it for decades. But in June of 1998, shortly before this story began, he knew he would soon have to reap what he'd been sowing most of his life. So now we're back to the dining room table, and Cody is about ready to confess into the tape recorder with Beth and Stacy sitting next to him. Cody explained that the body wrapped in the black garbage bags was that of 44-year-old Rebecca Holberton. His mortuary was her townhouse. 2 years earlier, he'd met Rebecca at an outdoor party. She was a lot different than him. She was more shy and reserved. She was attractive, tall, blonde, with curly hair, and had a professional job at U.S. West Telephone Company. Rebecca had been divorced for a few years and wasn't really looking for romance, but Cody, he laid on that charm.
Swept her off her feet.
He took her to the finest restaurants. He gave her roses, massages. The two began seeing each other almost daily, and Cody convinced her that it made sense for him to move in to her townhouse. He told her he knew all about remodeling and offered to do it. And then, of course, ripped up her house and never put it back together. That brown butcher paper had been over her windows for 2 full years.
Jeez. Damn.
During their relationship, Cody would sometimes paint houses to earn money. He explained to Rebecca, and are you ready for this heavy shit I'm going to give you? He explained to Rebecca that he was just doing this painting and earning money on the side until his trust fund came to fruition. According to Cody, years earlier, he was hired by the family to kill a rich man in Las Vegas. After confronting his intended victim with his imminent death, Cody decided to spare the man's life. This man was so grateful, Tanya, that he set up a trust fund for Cody. But Cody couldn't access it because he was caught in the middle of litigation in his divorce to Jennifer. But soon he was going to be a multi-millionaire.
Because you just can't change a trust.
Right, I know. After a few months of living together, Rebecca and Cody's romance fizzled. And they became more like roommates rather than lovers. They quit having sex. And Rebecca knew he was seeing other women. But for some reason, she continued to let him live there. And she even loaned him money. For 2 years, Cody siphoned Rebecca's life savings from her and convinced her to max out her credit cards, all with a promise she would be receiving a generous return on her investment in him. He would tug at Rebecca's heartstrings, telling her he needed money to get custody of his daughter because he was certain she was being abused. But again, he could have cared less about his daughter. He also convinced Rebecca to invest in some business ventures that didn't exist. Of course, course, nothing ever panned out. And after 2 years of living broke in a torn up home, Rebecca had had enough. She confronted him and told him that he needed to reimburse her for all the losses or she was going to go to the police. And he told her, just give me a little bit more time. To her surprise, on June 29th, Cody informed her that the funds had been released from the trust and she was going to get all her money back and some once it was deposited into his account. He convinced Rebecca to go ahead and write checks to all the various creditors that she was indebted to, assuring her the money would be in her bank account before the checks ever got cashed. He even had a special surprise awaiting her, he told her the next day, to show her how much he appreciated her patience and faith in him. Rebecca was super excited. She was so relieved that her financial problems would soon be over. The next morning, unbeknownst to Rebecca, Cody went to the builder's supply store and bought lava soap, nylon rope, duct tape, 4 large eye bolts, and a 7.5-pound splitting maul. He drove back to the townhouse, and he was greeted by Rebecca, who was still in her pajamas. He asked her if she was ready for her surprise. And according to Cody, she was filled with joy and happiness. He moved a chair from the dining room table into the center of the living room, placing it in front of the sliding glass door that led to their fenced-in backyard. He sat Rebecca on the chair and he placed a weighted briefcase on her lap, giving her the impression it was filled with money. In reality, it was stuffed with newspapers. Then he went into the kitchen and he grabbed a bottle of champagne and he poured each of them a glass so they could make a toast.
This guy is too much. This is just too much.
After setting his glass down, Cody grabbed a blanket and he tried to place it over her head, telling her that he didn't want her to see the last and final big surprise. She protested at first because she didn't want her hair to get messed up, but eventually she acquiesced. Promising her he would be right back, he went into the garage and he got the splitting maul out of his truck. Rebecca waited patiently with anticipation for her big surprise. Cody entered the house. He walked into the living room and he stood behind Rebecca. With a splitting maul raised up high, he aimed for the center of her head and he swung down on it with all his strength. Her hands flew up in the air as a reflex and he hit her again and again until the blanket that was covering her head ripped open and her brain matter began seeping through it. Cody removed the blanket and used a plastic bag to cover Rebecca's head so it would catch the oozing blood and brain matter. He wrapped some of the nylon rope he purchased earlier around her arms and legs and then placed her in the large garbage bags, securing the bags with more rope around and making her look like a crude mummy. After he was done, he sat on the chair to smoke a cigarette. That's when he noticed a piece of skull, approximately 2 inches in diameter, with Rebecca's hair still attached to it. He went and picked up that old ice cream bar wrapper from the floor and put the skull piece in it and put it on the kitchen counter. He justified killing her by telling himself that if she was stupid enough to believe his bullshit, she deserved to get fucked.
Wow. I know, I'm wondering, like, how does he manipulate all these people? He must have been really smooth and charming.
Yes. Clearly.
Extremely.
He's a con artist and he's a master manipulator and they manage, as we've experienced, you and I together, they manage to somehow convince you of these craziest things. Now Cody was ready for the next part of his plan. The surprise he had in store for Candace Walters. Cody changed the tape in the recorder to begin the next part of his confession. While Stacy and Beth sat at the table, frozen in fear, Cody relished reliving this murderous tale. He told the two women that he liked Candace from the very first moment he met her around Christmas in 1997. She worked as a bartender at the Sheraton Hotel in Denver, where Cody was staying for some reason. After her shift ended, the two of them sat around and talked until dawn the next morning. She was 48. She'd been divorced for 25 years with one adult daughter. Candace was an independent and strong-willed woman who enjoyed life. She was outgoing, as most bartenders are, and she hadn't had a real boyfriend in quite a few years. Cody fed Candace a line of bullshit about making $50 million in real estate ventures in Hawaii. He also told her he used to be a hitman, but made sure he only killed bad people who deserved it. Mm-hmm. And he assured her those days, they're long gone. He also explained his money by saying he sold rare gems. So stupid.
So stupid. Real estate developer slash hitman slash dealer in rare gems.
When you put it that way, he said most of his money was tied up in a trust account. Same bullshit he'd been saying. Not long after they started dating, he asked Candace if he could borrow $1,500, explaining that he needed it all in $1 bills to be bundled in bundles of 20.
So bizarre.
What the hell? Although she didn't have much as far as savings goes, she did lend him the money, and 2 days later, he paid her back, which confirmed to her that he was a man of his word. As time went by, and a few months passed, he asked her for $6,000. She'd been saving this money to go back to school and to buy her dream home, but she lent it to him anyway, making him sign a promissory note. So at least she did that.
Mm-hmm.
However, with this loan, Cody didn't get around to paying her back, and Candace grew concerned. In addition, Cody wouldn't let her know where he lived. He wouldn't let her have his phone number. She could only communicate with him by calling his pager. So this was a little bit odd. Candace had some internal conflict about Cody. He was so much fun, and he made her laugh, and they had the best of times together. But he would lie to her about little things. For example, one night, while she was out with Cody, he ran into the convenience store to get a pack of cigarettes. And while he was in the store, Candace searched his glove box and discovered that the car was registered to a Rebecca Holberton, a name she'd never heard before. She was pissed off and confused, and she confronted him about who is this Rebecca woman. And then they got into a fight, and she started yelling at him about how she wanted the money back. By that time, Cody had already been planning on murdering Rebecca, so he decided to just go ahead and throw Candace in the mix.
Why not?
Towards the end of June, he called Candace and told her not only was she going to be getting all of her money back, but he was going to throw in an extra $100,000 for the $6,000 she loaned him.
Stop it.
The next day, he told her that he bought each of them one-way tickets to Las Vegas. And then when they got there, there was going to be a brand new Toyota 4Runner waiting for her as a bonus gift. She could use that to drive back to Denver. A few days later, he told her that $1 million in cash would be waiting for her in Vegas. And he was going to wire her another $1.5 million into her bank account. He insisted she call her bank and figure out how he could perform such a large transaction. And she did. I know it may seem ridiculous to us, but we weren't there. True. But it does seem ridiculous.
A little bit.
And we weren't there?
A little bit. Like, here's an extra million and another million and a car and $100,000 and...
For that $6,000.
Yeah, for that $6,000.
He's a smooth talker, so... Right. The next day, he promised her a mansion in Las Vegas.
Oh my God.
Just a few doors down from his own. And he showed her pictures to back up his claims. All this had to be kept secret. It was part of the rules of the family, he told her. The plan was for the couple to leave in the afternoon of Friday, July 3rd. Cody convinced Candace to sell her car that day, since she wouldn't be needing it anymore. So she traded it into the dealership for $3,000.
Wow.
She didn't have a car now. He told her, don't pack any clothes, because we're going to go on this huge shopping spree when we get to Vegas. That Friday, he picked Candace up from the house, and they headed to the airport. There's various accounts of how he got Candace to agree to go to the townhouse. One is that he had a surprise, and one is that he had friends there with a surprise. Either way, he pulled into the West Chinago townhouse. He led Candace through the home and apologized for the mess. Because the butcher paper was covering the windows and blocking most of the light, she couldn't see the blood and the gore on the walls from Rebecca's murder. Using the same ruse that he used on Rebecca, he had Candace sit on the chair in the middle of the living room. She refused to allow her face to be covered with a blanket, but promised she would keep her eyes closed and wouldn't peek. Cody then placed the weighted briefcase on her lap, and he told her he'd be right back. Candace sat patiently in her white sundress, anxiously awaiting her first surprise. Then, out of nowhere, Cody came up behind her and smashed the splitting maul into her skull. She never knew what hit her. He jerked the blade out of her head and he hit her over and over and over and over again. Candace's body fell limp to the floor. And in a final act of degradation, Cody whipped out his dick from his tight blue jeans and he pissed on Candace's head and shoulders. God, what an ass.
Jeez. I'm flabbergasted by this story.
It's so fucked up.
It is.
Candace never did anything to him.
No.
Not that any of these women did.
No, not that any of them did. Just fucking nuts.
Just like Rebecca, Candace's only crime was falling for this calculated and cold con artist. And with that, Cody shut off the tape recorder. Beth and Stacy had no idea how Cody planned to end this murder story, but they doubted that they would make it out alive. That night, he held both women hostage in their apartment at gunpoint. The next morning, to their surprise, he told them he had a few errands to run, and he was going to leave them there alone. They didn't have any phones, but he warned them if they tried to escape, he would kill many more people. They didn't know what to do or if it was some sort of test, so they stayed in the apartment, walking around like zombies, barely mumbling a word to each other. Eventually, Cody returned. He told Beth and Stacy that he'd figured out how he was going to end this. He was going to find a remote area to commit suicide. But he wanted to make sure his story was heard first. He called a drinking buddy of his named Steve Grund, who was also a reporter. Steve didn't answer, so Cody left a message on his machine telling him to give him a call because he had a huge story to share. Now this is where I really can't make any sense of Cody, in case I possibly could before. He suggested to Beth and Stacy that perhaps they should call a male friend of theirs to come over because he knew that they felt uncomfortable around him and they were afraid of him. So maybe a male presence would make them a little bit more at ease. Told him to call somebody they could trust, but wouldn't try to overpower him. The woman agreed to call their very unlucky friend, David Kane.
I know, I'm thinking, why are you inviting anybody over?
I don't know.
To join this mess.
I mean, maybe in the end he made them. I don't know. But they ended up calling best friend, David Kane. He's 30 years old. He'd been friends for years with Beth. Beth used a cordless phone to call him up and see if he wanted to hang out at her place later. He did. When David arrived, Beth let him in, and Cody immediately greeted him with a .25 caliber revolver. With a gun pointed to his head, Cody told David he had two options. He could walk out of that apartment unharmed with his life spared. No questions asked. But if he does that, one of the two women inside are going to die. Or he could risk staying with these women in the apartment and perhaps die himself. David chose to stay. All three hostages were forced to sit around the table, and guess what Cody did?
He played the tape?
He played the tape!
Oh my God. Wow.
For 2 hours, David, Stacy, and Beth had to listen to that murder confession with Cody again. The tape ended around midnight, and by that time, Cody had worked up an appetite to party. He liked to go out and party. At gunpoint, David, Stacy, and Beth were made to go to a strip club called All Star Strip Club, where Cody bought rounds over and over again for his companions and would every now and then flash the gun that he kept tucked in his waistband to remind them, you better behave. The group stayed at the strip club until it closed and then went back to the apartment. By the next morning, Cody knew he had to end this debacle. He called his reporter friend Steve Grund again, and this time Steve answered. Imagine Steve's astonishment when Cody once again confessed his barbaric crimes to him. At first, Steve didn't believe him, so Cody put Stacy on the phone, and she verified the veracity of the tale. After his conversation with Steve, Cody was ready to put his suicide plan into action. He gave explicit instructions to Stacy and Beth about how he wanted them to call the police and all these things, but it didn't matter. Once he left the apartment, they just called 911. At the time the police were responding to Stacy's call, another group of officers were doing a welfare check on behalf of Rebecca Holberton's sister. Rebecca's sister had been trying to reach her for days and got no response. When she found out that Rebecca failed to show up for her first day at a new position at her job, she called the police. When they got to the townhouse, they thought it was kind of strange that every window and every door was covered with paper. It made it impossible for them to even peek inside. After getting no response at the front door, the police went around to the back. The sliding glass door was unlocked, so they kind of just let themselves in. I'm sure it's all legal. Probably not. And of course, what they saw resembled some sort of torture chamber of death.
Mortuary.
Welcome to my mortuary.
Welcome to my mortuary.
Oh my God. Anyway, it was only minutes before the officers were able to connect Stacy and Beth's story with the bodies found at Rebecca's townhouse. Using Beth's phone, the police paged Cody, and he called them back immediately. It's like, hey!
Hey, I'm returning your call.
An investigator named Cheryl Zimmerman, she spoke with Cody for almost an hour, encouraging him to turn himself in. Cody requested to speak to a public defender to first discuss his options. Now, this put the police in a really precarious situation. They didn't want to get a third-party citizen involved in this violent scenario. And Cody had no right to an attorney because he wasn't arrested. So instead, the county prosecutor, his name was Mark Palter, he got on the phone and said, hey, my name's Mark Palmer. I'm a public defender. Wink, wink. He claimed that he was a defense attorney. He convinced Cody to turn himself in to the police. At around 8:30, Cody met the police at a mall parking lot. Probably not the safest place to meet someone like Cody. And he was arrested without incident. There's a little more to the story I have to share with you. The Jefferson County prosecutor I told you about, Mark Palter, because he pretended to be a defense attorney, a public defender, and got Cody to turn himself in under a ruse, he was found by the Colorado Supreme Court to have committed professional misconduct.
Are you kidding me?
He was suspended from practicing law for 3 months, ordered to take continuing education classes, and placed on professional probation for a year.
Wow.
That's ridiculous.
It is.
What he did was heroic, but that's just my opinion. After Cody's arrest, he admitted his guilt to the detectives. As you can imagine, he's telling everybody, guess what I did? Here's my tape.
Right. Did he have the tapes with him? Did he leave them behind, you know?
He left them behind. Mm. Although he pled guilty, he still had to convince a 3-person panel to spare him from the death penalty. And Cody decided to be his own attorney.
Of course he did.
But the problem he had is there were no real mitigating factors for him to offer. So he didn't even try. I mean, as I said, he admitted, I came from an all-American family. My mom, I loved her so much.
She was awesome. Everybody loved her.
And it's true. At his sentencing hearing, Cody showed up wearing a shiny wedding band on his finger. It was from a woman he'd met years ago at a bar near Denver. She was a trust fund baby. She was loaded with money, and she made sure Cody had everything he needed in prison. And as far as I know, they got married.
Are you kidding me?
No, I know he petitioned for it.
After he was convicted, they got married?
Yes.
That's amazing.
He's a charmer.
Fucking A.
It's those tight blue jeans.
And the cowboy hat.
Sorry.
I gotta see a picture of this guy.
You're not gonna like
him. Really?
You can go to our website, TNT Crimes.
Yes, I will take it. I will check it out.
On September 29th, 1999, a three-judge panel handed down three death sentences to Cody. But in 2003, the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that a three-judge panel sentencing someone to death was unconstitutional, so he was resentenced to life. As of recent, he's still in prison, and he's still chasing after women. I found his profile on five different prison pen pal sites. I'm going to read just a few snippets from some of them, okay?
Okay.
This is from Kite Connection. Hello! I love full-figured women. That's right, it's me, Cody! And there's all these exclamations all over, by the way. Ride, cowboy, ride! Exclamation, exclamation. I'm looking forward to hearing from you soon. And if you're on the, quote, fence, go ahead and take a, quote, leap of faith. And let's get this ride started. My friends call me Wild Bill Cody, and I've always enjoyed living life to the fullest.
Including murdering three women.
I'm very open-minded, and I'm forever young at heart. I look forward to writing anyone. What you gonna do with a cowboy who loves life and is truly looking forward to meeting you as not just a pen pal, but as a friend?
So stupid.
I can't promise you an easy ride, but I can promise you that you will live life to the fullest, no matter the circumstances, and with gusto, passion, and more. I'm willing to try new things. Are you? What you gonna try in prison, buddy?
I know. And how is he going to help someone live life to the fullest? Through a letter?
I guess. He lists a whole bunch of things he loves. Are you ready?
Yes. Yeah.
He loves writing, horses, scuba diving, music of all kinds, dancing, cats and dogs. Except for the one he stabbed with
exactly.
A fork. Rodeos. Romance novels. Sookie Stackhouse books.
Oh, I know those. Remember True Blood on HBO?
Yes.
Did you ever watch it?
No.
She was Sookie Stackhouse, and they were based on the books.
Of course he would like that.
Yes.
He likes bird watching. Because it's about all he can do in a cell.
Seriously. Out of all those things you've just mentioned, that's really the one he can do.
Exploring new things. The wilderness. Chocolate. Gummy bears, Sudoku, haiku, skiing, exercise, cooking, 50 Shades of Grey books, volunteer work, travel, legal studies, room service.
He's getting a lot of that in prison.
Water sports, photography, helping others, and much more. Life is meant to be lived and shared.
What the hell, dude? You're not going to be doing any of that.
He can fuck right off.
Yes.
So this is a little excerpt from Writer Prisoner. I have many interests, which I've already told you about. This part pisses me off, though. He wrote, I love my daughter more than my pickup truck, and that's big love.
Oh, fuck you.
Isn't that horrible?
Yes.
His guilty pleasures are romance novels and chocolate. He's an avid outdoorsman. His favorite animal is a bear, since he's a bit of a cub. I don't even know what that means.
I don't either.
It's in quotes.
Okay.
Now, this snippet is from Pen-a-con.
Pen-a-con, yeah.
Clever. Search no more. It's me, Cody. Hello. This cowboy could use some good friends right now. And if you're looking at this ad, I'm sure you could use one too. Yes. And maybe some therapy. That's me, Cody. I'm forever young at heart, and I'm still wanting to try new things, live life to the fullest.
Blah, blah, blah. Same shit.
Yeah, I used to own a business before I murdered some people. No, he didn't put that in there.
Yeah, I'm sure he didn't.
He has a deep, heartfelt passion to help others in prison and outside prison. After years of deep soul searching, he's found beauty, strength, peace, and love and humility. He's embraced his shortcomings and left his childish things behind him, and he's became a man. And then I wrote, blah, blah, blah.
He's left his childish things behind him. What the heck does that mean? I love how he's wanting to try new things. You ain't trying shit, buddy.
Well, like, there's probably a couple new things he's trying in prison, but I don't know if it's voluntary. Anyway, that is the story of Wild Bill Cody.
What
a
complete psycho.
Yeah. He never killed anybody before, and then it just went on a rampage.
I know, like, and what was that thing called?
Splitting mall.
Like, what the fuck? Seriously.
7.5 pounds.
I'm picturing it and terrifying.
Yeah. I got my information from court records. I got it from all those prison pen pal sites. There was a great book by a guy named Steve Jackson called Love Me to Death. And I think that's pretty much the gist of it. He also wrote an article. And that is the story of the week. I appreciate everybody for taking the time to listen to that. And if you haven't done so already, please hit the subscribe/follow button on the app you're listening to us in so you can get weekly updates. And if you like this story and you want to get stories that are exclusive, we have a membership with lots of amazing, beautiful people in it. And you can go to our website, tntcrimes.com, to learn more, or go to Patreon, patreon.com/tntcrimes. And I think we have almost 70 full unreleased episodes there, a whole bunch of minis. We go live every couple weeks in a Facebook group, so check it out. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hardcore True Crime. Anything else, Tanya?
No, I think that's it.
I think that's it.
Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.